It is my pleasure to introduce Paul Pangaro's lecture today. I am Daniel Cardoso. I'm the chair of the Master of Science in Computational Design, which is a program that interrogates critical opportunities and creative opportunities at the intersection of design and computation. It is a really great pleasure to welcome Paul to the lecture today as part of the Computational Design lecture series. Paul studied theater, film criticism, and computer science as an undergrad at MIT, and he spent the remainder of his time there acting in plays and writing software for interactive graphics and computer-generated film. After finishing, he worked on neural simulations and then joined the Architecture Machine Group, the group led by Nicolas Negroponte, and that preceded the Media Lab, where he met British cybernetician Gordon Pask and pursued a PhD with him at Brunel University in the UK, where he applied Pask's conversation theory framework to software systems for learning. So as those of you who have taken Molly's class or some of my classes, you know that Gordon Pask is an important character who had like a very outsized influence in the fields of design and architecture, in no small part through figures such as Negroponte and Cedric Price, and who actually shaped our architectural and design understanding of technology as conversational. So, although not explicitly architectural, Paul has drawn from these experiences and learnings and developed a very interesting career in startups and consulting. He has built systems for interacting with content, has proposed methods for organizational transformation and innovation, and designed the process of design all based in conversation models. From 2015 on, he chaired the MFA Interaction Design program at the College for Creative Studies in Detroit. And in January 2019, he joined us here at Carnegie Mellon as professor of the practice in the Human-Computer Interaction Institute. I was lucky to meet Paul 6 years ago when I was preparing to moderate a panel with many of the original members of the Architecture Machine Group at a conference at MIT. And we have stayed in touch since around different projects, and I'm really grateful to have counted with his insights as I prepared different projects and my book and exhibition. And I think we can all learn from his generosity and articulation. Paul's work on human-machine conversation is extremely generative and will surely resonate with a lot of the work that we are conducting in different programs here at Carnegie Mellon, and particularly with work we're doing at the Code Lab, where so many projects comprise reimaginings of the designing and making process as the encounter between human and technological agencies. Further, I think we can all learn from his work, more recent work, and his articulation. So I'm thrilled, Paul, to have you here. Thank you so much for coming to the lecture.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming out on such a beautiful spring day. It seems auspicious that one might come here on such a beautiful day. This talk is a contradiction in terms. I'm talking about something that I would much rather have us all experience, but of course, the format of the lecture is to talk at you and for you to tolerate it. So I hope you will do that, but I want to give a small remedy. And the remedy is that I will refuse to give a simple, clear definition of conversation. And there's an advantage in this. Because if I refuse to give you my definition, you, in your head, so to speak, will have your definition, which will have friction with all of the different ways that I will talk about it to you today. So thus, I hope to engage you in your own conversation in your head to compare what you think of when you hear the word conversation and all of the many faceted ways of introducing it to you today. This work by Philip Beasley and his group, Living Architecture Systems Group, I can't recommend highly enough. These pieces are extraordinary, analog, organic, immersive, and interactive to a degree that is amazing in a sense, amazing because there are so many sensors and so many lights, and the various ways in which it interacts with the public are many. And I encourage you to go look at that. But here I have a statement of irony. This piece, which was done 50 years ago, is more interactive. It's more interactive in the sense that it enables a kind of a conversation. And this is a piece by Gordon Pask. It's called The Colloquy of Mobiles. It appeared as if from outer space in a gallery in London 50 years ago, as I say, at the Institute for Contemporary Arts. I don't know what people made of it then, but I'm sure it was quite amazing. Here's Gordon himself standing in front of one of the mobile forms, the so-called male mobile. We'll get to the metaphor in a moment. This is Yolande Sonneband, who designed the female forms, who is already famous and became yet more famous still because of her work at the Royal Ballet in London, doing costumes and sets. Now, the context of this exhibit, the Colloquy of Mobiles in London 50 years ago, was an exhibit called Cybernetic Serendipity. And this is the original poster of an era, wouldn't you say? The exhibition had over 130 works of art, mostly static graphics, some music, in various galleries. It ran for 3 or 4 months. It had 11,000 visitors, I think. Or was it 60,000? I should know that number. And a couple of the installations were interactive. This form here that you see would go toward you as you spoke to it. If you yelled, it would ignore you. If you were more reasonable and quiet, it would respond. But Pask's piece, The Colloquy of Mobiles, was the most extraordinary and the most complex. And last year, in Detroit, owing to some extraordinary partners, we reproduced it. So this is, again, the original gallery piece. Here it is in the reproduction. It was a very, very interesting project. I'd like to describe a little bit of how a kind of conversation took place. So here you have a male mobile with a light, which is serendipitously moving around, and a female, which is also rotating. And when the light from the male hits the mirror on the female just right and reflects back to the male, they stop and they interact. So the sounds that you hear and the flapping of the mirror is the responsiveness. And the male turns its light on full and then has these other senses down below, waiting for the mirror on the female to reflect the light back from the male. Here we're simulating a little bit with a flashlight. And this is the point, of course. You can have gallery goers to interact with these mobiles. So the mobiles don't know whether they're human or mobiles that they're interacting with. But the people in the gallery can play around by interrupting the light beams or using flashlights. Now, what is this thing and why did we want to make it? It's my contention that the Colloquy of Mobiles is a kind of pivot point, certainly in Pask's work and also in interactive art. And you can read the articles on this, there are quite a few of them. But in going about reproducing it, I want to tell you a little more of that story very, very quickly. And then I want to go through a little more history and explain why it's conversational. So you can imagine seeing this thing and wanting to make it again. What did we have? We had flowcharts in the hand of Gordon Pask himself. We had an article that he wrote that was published in this book by the same curator who did the original piece, in which he talks about novelty. He provided some plans, and there are these very, very grainy black and white movies, which would be difficult to see even if the room were completely black. It's very, very hard to see. Here's a master shot, or a close-up, that's a little bit easier to see. And here's the man himself explaining it. Now, you'll see there'll be a script on the left and right side so you can follow in case his accent is a little bit problematic. This is Gordon Pask.
In the classroom or several places like that, that is a machinery, hardly discernible perhaps, for running a colloquy of mobiles, as it was called. That was a long way up here. These were large suspended mobiles. And I was taxed with the ability of making an exhibition piece for entertainment, in fact, with which people would engage in conversations through. So I made a family of mobiles, which were these things, you know, all mechanically rotatable beams, an environment out of a PEPA computer, smaller. And what in those days would be equivalent to a microprocessor, a load of junk in each form. Point being that the mobiles had a little life of their own. They chatted to each other by beams of light, which they waggled up and down, and by hooting sounds and so forth, and anybody could go into that discourse if they wanted to and hoot at them or put their hand up in front of the light. And they did.
And they did. I wanted to give you a taste of the man. We have another clip coming up. But I think it's important to get a flavor of him and his the time warp that he lived in. And if any of you know Doctor Who, not kidding, the original Doctor Who is a mirror of Pask, and Pask was probably the inspiration for it. This is a known issue. So I'm going to tell you a little more about the making of it, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have T.J. McLeish. T.J., raise your hand at least. T.J. is driven from Detroit just to be here today, somewhat unexpectedly. But it's because of him that we were able to reproduce this thing. He was the master fabricator. And we'll take you through a bit of the process, because as architects, I think you might be interested in this. The first thing, of course, that we learned is that this original diagram on the left is wrong. It's not actually the geometry of the piece as it was built. And the configuration of sensors and lights on the male figures shown here are also just plain wrong. We also have some text from Pask. Consider a female. She has an O drive and a P drive. Very Freudian, very gender jokey. And we had two student classes who extricated what they could from the available resources, which I'll take you through a little further. This was a piece of logic that they did. And here they are acting out what they think the behaviors were. I have an O drive. That's what I'm looking for, et cetera. They're going to go back and forth and carry out what they knew to be the behaviors as they understood. Anyway, this is one of many possible shots. A different class built a scale model. And here's it working a little bit, where when the light from the male hits the female stops and waggles its. This was for a prototyping class. It's easy to build a scale model. What's much harder is to build a large, full-scale replica that looks and behaves the way it ought to. And this was the task that TJ set about, taking all of the photographs that were available, not many, and then building a 3D model. And for various reasons, we did hire a fabricator to build the female models. I think the pictures tell the story. And ultimately, when coated in fiberglass, came out looking like this. And then we built it in the spaces of the interaction design program at the College for Creative Studies in Detroit. Now, what you see here are actually TJ's designs. He had to figure out how to create structure to hold on to these mobiles. And we worked with students to assemble. TJ also did the electronics, starting from breadboards into circuit boards, taking off-the-shelf parts, but also using 3D printing to build holders for the motors and other things. And this is the construction process. We documented it all. You can go to colloquyofmobiles.com, where much of the documentation is. And actually, there's a vast repository of material, which we're, of course, open sourcing and making available. We had a couple of openings. The work then and now explores the dynamics of conversing with machines, now occurring every day, the impact of smart environments, etc. The students had a ball. We had a ball. We got some wonderful press in Hyperallergic, which you must be familiar with. But of course, as time goes on, one has to put the toys away and wait for another moment. So they're in mothballs now. But we've had very serious inquiries, both from the ZKM Museum, you surely know, in Karlsruhe, Germany, Arts and Media Museum in Germany. But also Centre Pompidou has made a very serious inquiry. And we're interacting with a curator there and the deputy director, who wrote to me this marvelous email separately. He said, "Paul, Gordon Pask isn't well enough known in France. Will you help me?" Oui. It was an easy email to respond to, and here's TJ as we put it all to bed. So what's this for? Why are we going through this? Where did it come from? And what did it mean? Well, Pask from the very, very beginning was about conversation. And I'd like to bring you through a very quick tour of some of his works, by no means not all of them. And Colloquy is a kind of pivot point, as I said. So we'll look through these three or four works. There were many more before and many more after, but this is the concentration. I want to give you a taste of conversation. Imagine you're in a music hall and there are lights strewn around. This is symbolic, it's not literal. Five different lights. And they're shining on these scrims. And these lights are driven by a piece of machinery that you wouldn't want to stand next to, partly because it's hot and partly because it may explode. Not kidding, it often caught fire. This is a fact. And the way it worked is someone would play an instrument, which would be captured by a microphone into the music color machine, and the result would be lights, and of course the loop would be closed by the person watching the lights, and then let's see what might happen. So let's describe this in feedback terms and then understand why it's a kind of conversation. So the main loop would be I'm playing, and the system wants to give me something, so it becomes sensitive enough to give me light. So if I play very loudly, it gets very, very bright and kind of jammed at the end, so that's not good, so it gets less sensitive, and I start to play much more softly, then it gets more sensitive. Simple Hunter circuit, first order feedback. But you may expect that when I play the bass, it gives me green, and when I play the treble, it gives me yellow, which would be trivial very quickly and would be annoying. And most reactive systems that we have today are no more complex than that. But Pask was a conversation guy, and he knew that he wanted to have a second layer. And so if I'm playing between middle C and C above C, and it's responding to me, because remember, no matter what I do, it's trying to give me something to look at. But then what happens is it gets bored. And instead of listening in this frequency range, it shifts the frequency range. So I'm playing, and it's responding, playing, and it's responding, and then it's not responding anymore. So I'm going to change what I'm doing until it responds again. It's a bit like you're having a conversation with somebody and they kind of drift off. And so you want to do something to get them engaged again, right? So this was doing that. It was doing it in five channels. And it was constantly changing what it was listening to as a way of keeping your attention. So now in the first of a series of extractions, I'd like to tell you how I think about what was going on and offer them as principles. So this is novelty regulation. It's regulating the novelty in the interaction by detecting repetition, getting bored, and then changing its responsiveness in order to maintain engagement. A simple conversation, for sure, but nonetheless a conversation. Not words, not chatbots, but still happening. 1953. Here's another machine which was not for entertainment, but rather for training. This taught people how to type. It's a very primitive keyboard that you see on the lower right. It's not the QWERTY keyboard, it was more complicated than that. And on the piece itself was a strip of film with lights behind the film that would turn on one light, next light, next light, next light, to tell you what to type next. And it would speed up to encourage you to learn the skill, but if you failed, it would slow down. So it's constantly tracking where can it be such that it's challenging you, but not too much. 1956. Well, how did he do this? A piece of film is not digital. So he made a plug board, which is there, and here's a better shot of it. So here's a strip of film sitting in front of a row of lights. The lights aren't shown. And each one of these plugs is 128 bytes of information, depending on how the pins are wired or rewired. So the first of many examples of, if you have a great idea, the technology doesn't hold you back. You figure out some way of making it. But in general, the principle here is uncertainty regulation. So there's an uncertainty in the learning exchange such that if you make it too uncertain for the student, you make it really, really complicated and fast, then the student fails, so you back off and you make it easier. And this constant finding the right place is what Pask called uncertainty regulation. And this happens every day, right? You say something and the person says, what does that mean? And you realize you've gone too far, so you back off and you come forward. There are a couple of more machines I want to do very briefly. This was a pupil machine that was taught by a teacher machine. These were neural nets. It's a very early neural net in the 50s. And there isn't time to describe it, but these were also double loops. And the function of the teacher machine was to teach the pupil essentially a configuration. And this is a board that existed on this machine that was called Eucrates, which is a quote from Plato, you can look it up. So on this board were all of these wonderful controls for the pupil. The student machine. So you can control how much internal awareness it had, how much external awareness it had, but there are some wonderful ones here. Here's one called obstinacy. So while you're doing this experiment with a teaching machine and a student machine, and you could turn up the obstinacy of the student. What an imagination. My favorite, however, is this one. This is the oblivescence. It's similar to oblivious, but only in a British dictionary will you read the meaning that he intended, which is willful forgetfulness. It had the same architecture that I'm arguing is the fundamental architecture of conversations of all kinds as it comes from Pask. Now, what this gets you actually is interesting. It gets you a form of autonomy in the machine. So this is a machine-to-machine autonomy. People play with this a little bit here and there. Those early images I showed you of the amazing organic forms, they're not double loop, but there is a sort of autonomy happening there, but not of a learning kind and not one that regulates the back and forth. One last one, mostly for fun. This is a proposal for a cybernetic theater in which people in an audience such as yourself would watch actors acting, and every 2.5 minutes would push a button and change the direction of the narrative. Now, we know about non-linear narratives, and we know about games and all that kind of stuff. He had this idea. There are many, many diagrams in this little proposal, which exists only as a manuscript, although he was interacting with theater people who were very serious, and who also interacted actually with Cedric Price, a woman named Joan Littlewood. And here is one of the diagrams of many in which you could build it. Again, it's sort of like music color. There's an idea, you could build it if you wanted to. But it has the same form. There are multiple layers and multiple kinds of interaction, and we'll come back to that. So this is the timeline so far, and this is what I've shown you so far. So here's another little clip of Gordon.
Giving, say, two explanations at once will be represented by putting a marker of some sort on some of these and saying,
we're dealing with conversations as the things we study. We're not much interested in what the conversation is about. We're interested in how it takes place. And the hypotheses we test are about how people understand or learn or what can be known and can't be about processes in conversations.
I mean somebody with the wit and the guts to go and do and create. And that, I believe, is what education is all about.
He loved to play the mad scientist, can't you tell? He really relished it, and he was really, really good at it. Particularly at 2 o'clock in the morning when you've been there for 6 or 8 hours and you're just trying to absorb all of this stuff. This was a half-hour show that was on the BBC, solely about Pask and about his work. Up to the mid-70s. Around this time, he started to formalize his ideas about conversation. And he sketched a series of models that in his own hand looked like this. Notice the cigarette burn. And I think you're going to see the architecture of it in the sense of the structure and the loops I've been showing you. But let me show you the timeline first. So we're going to look at a system called ThoughtSticker and called the Architecture Machine, which I'll talk about at some length. This is ThoughtSticker. This was the room as it existed when I first went to England. It was a very, very damp basement where you didn't want to spend a lot of time. And an extraordinary range of machinery here. These were very early storage tubes that Nicholas Negroponte gave to Pask because Nicholas didn't need them anymore and Gordon could really use them. They were the only dynamic graphic displays that Pask had. One point is, well, let me back up. So this was an experimental situation to follow the conversations between material that students learn and the students themselves.
and Pask had developed by then and continued to develop ways of characterizing learning styles, story for another time. But the gist of it was that this was a knowledge representation, and the student could say, I want to learn this, and the system would decide what to present to that student next based on uncertainty regulation. Because after a few interactions, the system has some sense of what the student knows and doesn't know, and so can say, all right, if I present this explanation, there are three unknowns, that's probably not going to work. But if I present this explanation, there are two unknowns, but they're not unknown anymore because the student just dealt with these. It's a bit like saying after we've talked for a while, we have a shared vocabulary. And based on that shared vocabulary, people every day decide what to say next based on what they think will be understood by the other person. We do it intuitively. We've been talking for 100,000 years. The biology is getting good at it, right? Helping us. The challenge here, though, was that he didn't have enough storage on his 8-inch floppy to store the text that the students were supposed to read. So, whoops, I apologize. There we go. So based on the student making a choice here, a little LED would go on above a cubby hole, and the student would pull out a clipboard and read the paper text. It's the powerful idea that tells you what to do with technology. It's not a question of how powerful or not the question is. So this was thought sticker of the time. This is a very famous shot, which many of you, I think, already know. This is Nicholas in the back. Nicholas Negroponte, in front of a system that he called Seek, which was a gerbil blocks world, kind of a play on what Terry Winograd had done some time before. Here's one of the actual blocks, which is a lot of fun to pass around. And the idea was that a video camera would see how the gerbils were rearranging the blocks and say, oh, that was purposeful behavior. And the machine, the camera, the hand, and the software would then reproduce that configuration elsewhere. It's a bit like saying, architects in the world see how I configure my room, and so it gives me other rooms configured that way, or buildings, or whatever. This was the idea. And this was quite a sensation at the time. And it was published in various ways. And this is a book called Soft Architecture Machines. You must know Molly Wright Steenson's book, in which he talks about the history quite extensively. Pask was asked by Nicholas Negroponte to write a chapter on machine intelligence. And that's why he generated these diagrams. And Nicholas, in a moment of genius, instead of passing Gordon's handwritten graphics to a graphic designer to be rendered in some, you know, aesthetic way, which would take away all of its character, Nicholas reproduced the original drawings. He drew around them in a magic marker to emphasize certain things. But he kept the originals. I want to take you through just a little tiny bit of this. This paper is extraordinary. It's a rigorous formalism of conversation. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I'm going to tell you a little bit of its pieces. This might be the most important idea here. Pask realized that in conversations, an observer can watch the conversation and say, well, you're talking about the goal, the thing it is that is the reason why you're in the conversation. Oh, no, wait a minute. You're not talking about the goal anymore. Now you're talking about the means to achieve the goal. And if you stratify conversations in this way, you learn a lot about what's going on, but you also learn how to renegotiate things. And you realize you can keep the goal and find many, many different means to achieve the goal. Or you may find that the goal is not the goal that you want because there's a higher level goal. So the classic case is, let's go to dinner, that's terrific, I don't like Thai food, well, I'm busy, no, can't afford it, I'm sorry, I don't have... Well, we didn't really want to go to dinner, we want to go to dinner in order to have a conversation. Well, let's have a conversation tomorrow at tea. So a fundamental of conversation is, of course, collaborating on what might be done and to lead toward new kinds of opportunities. And by stratifying it, you can then actually break out the environment and realize that you could also make a machine. So this is the architecture machine. The right side is
is of the machine itself. It's hard to read. Can you read it? Interface consisting in display tubes and sketch pads, etc. Inductive learning routines, operating routines, you'll get the hang. Environment of objects, instantiating relationships R sub I, and includes internal abstract models, etc. The point is that if you have this architecture, in the sense of structure, I use that word, I shouldn't use it quite the way I'm using it now, in goals and means, you could build an architecture machine. So what does this mean? Instead of having a machine in which I'm saying, render that 3D thing, or compute for me the size of a beam, instead you're saying, why would I want the kitchen next to the living room? Why would I want a facade that looks the way it looks and has certain emissive surfaces and so on? In the same way that you would do this with a collaborator who is a person. So the outlandishness of this idea, which Nicholas took very seriously for a number of years, and then he got distracted by building the Media Lab and dropped it and never went back to it. Yeah. That's a loss as far as I'm concerned. It's an unexplored territory. If you can talk to each other about why you're doing things separately from how you're doing them, an enormous amount becomes possible. So this is another principle. There's one more point about these diagrams, which is that if we literally dance, you might agree to dance, and I might take my partner, and I might shove the shoulder of my partner. So I'm actually reaching down. I have a goal up here, and I'm the means of achieving the goal of dancing is I'm reaching down across, and I'm pushing the shoulder of my partner. But my partner doesn't say, "How dare you?" My partner realizes that the goal is to dance, and so my partner pushes me back. So you get this back and forth, which essentially collapses the division between me and my partner such that we're unified and we're acting as a single system. This is a formal model of conversation in terms of feedback. And it's just this again. Okay. So this is the story we've had so far. Here's a picture of Gordon and his wife Elizabeth in the study, London. And this is his work, but now the question is, where do we take it from here? And now in a short interval, I'd like to ask you to do a little bit of reading. So in an age of Alexa and so on, we need to encounter this idea of conversation, and we need to ask the question, what is it at its best? And are we getting it from the technology that we have? I think we all know what a great conversational partner is. I'd like to offer some modest proposals of work based on conversation theory. This was a version of ThoughtSticker that was my PhD. It was done in an AI workstation. I really prefer PASCs, the one with the messy things and the cubby holes and the LEDs and so on. But it can be done in a newer technology. Here's a much more modern version. This was a system called Thought Shuffler that we built in the startup in the earlier time. So these are keywords, and by clicking the keywords on and off, almost like typing into the Google control line, you would vary what you were searching for, and each card represents a result, and it actually shuffles in priority depending on you turning things on and off. And there were lots of other very complicated aspects to the interface. People said, that's great for researchers, go away. So we simplified it and made it more beautiful. The most interesting version, and this, by the way, is tricky because I can't start and stop it. You're on the phone and you want to both search and read. You type in National Geographic and fracking, and it says, well, hey, you can think of those two terms in black in the context of these white terms. Each one of these is a search result, and here's a paragraph chosen for you based on uncertainty regulation. And that paragraph is part of a much longer thing, which you can expand and look at. or you can narrow down to the individual paragraph. This was iOS code. It was running in real time. It used Google as a backend. Now, you can also change the clusters. So this is a different combination. I still typed in the black ones, and it's providing the white ones. So it's giving you context after context after context in which you can interpret the search, if you will. And here, finally, is navigating based on the contexts rather than navigating based on the terms. And this is quite wonderful. We brought it to VCs, and they said, so what's your back end? And we say, oh, Google is our back end. And they'd say, what? I said, yeah, there's an API. It runs in real time. It runs on AWS. You know, it's doing all this stuff, and it's got, you know, PASC stuff in the background, and just computing uncertainty. And they said, no, I want to go back to this thing about Google. You need Google to make this run? Yeah. Thank you. Meeting over. So that was it. It needed too much power. It needed too much in the back end. This was another version where you rolled over a link and things popped up. So what's the point? The point is that it doesn't really matter the medium in which you're trying to do conversation. It can be a light show when you play music. It can be these mobiles that do this. It can be content. But if you have a model of what conversation is, exchanges about goals separate from exchanges about the means to achieve those goals, then you can build things. And I offer this as a kind of challenge. You also don't, this by the way was a version that didn't need an iOS load. This ran in a browser on the phone. But you can take these ideas and you can apply them to other areas. So this was the application of conversation theory and a number of other things, not the only thing, to organizational change. And it was an examination of why great companies do well for a while and then kill themselves. I'm not exaggerating. And the gist of it is that an organization is what it can talk about, the conversations it can have. And after a while, the conversations it can have become stagnant and limited. So you can apply it to organizational design. Another application in a work I did for a big advertising firm in New York was, can we design not the project or the team, but design the cadence of conversation, such that every time you have a conversation, there's new knowledge generated, but then you're going to have another conversation. Who are the people in that conversation that you need that are different than the people in the conversation you had before? And what kind of information do you need? So a purely designing of conversational cadence was this. Here's another quick idea for the poetry magazine. They wanted to build a new search engine. And I said, well, you have to tell me what poetry is. And the editor laughed and talked about enactment and other things. This is a very quick tour. The problem is that you have a poet who's generated the text, and you have a reader, but there's a barrier between the two because the reader doesn't know the context, history, biography, and poetical forms that the poet knows. So here you build an enactment layer. You build a kind of Pascian buffer so that the reader can interact with the text and have uncertainty regulated and have novelty regulated. That's really too short, but I have to keep going. This is a theory of design. This says that you have conversations about goals when you're designing something, and you have conversations about the means to achieve those goals separately. But the limitation, as I said a couple of slides ago, is how do you create new language when your old language isn't working anymore? And you need to design the design. Again, applying a serious model of conversation to a number of new areas. You've been very patient. I have a little bit further to go. This is the time when PASC would give a talk and you'd think, okay, I've had enough, that's it. And yet he would go on another hour. I'm not going to do that, but I would like to go a little further. He had aid, by the way, his form of, he was, you know, different era. Dexedrine was his. So anyway, declaring intentions. I would like to use conversation as the basis for thinking about interface design and interaction design. And I would like to use conversation as a kind of foundation. So a cooperative interface. And here I need to interrupt with a short parable. I need someone who's willing to have a very brief conversation with me. Would anyone like to volunteer? Please. So I need you to ask me, where is there good pizza? Where is there a good pizza? There's the best pizza is right across the street at Luigi's Pizza. And now ask me, why is it the best pizza?
Why is it the best pizza?
Screw you, I'm not going to tell you. I just described Google. Right? That's not very nice. And in fact, you wouldn't allow a person to do that to you, right? And yet we allow our machines to do it. That seems like a stretch. So can we define an ethical interface when there's reliable transparency about what it's giving me and why it's giving it to me, so that we may build trust? Now, just telling me what it used to decide might be as bad as looking at terms and conditions, right? It might give me 25 pages. So although it's ethical, if you believe what it's telling you, and you can't in a lot of cases, I know that. But let's assume that it's true, this 25 pages. But the problem is that in that interface, requiring me to read 25 pages, it's not humane. So I would like to build a humane interface where either participant, any participant, can influence the focus and flow. So I'm moving from the idea of what conversation is and its structure to how it might be applied to other areas. I'm almost done. So one place to look for direction is to riff on past. So we can just look at these and we can apply them. I've been doing it. I invite anyone to do it. I'm sure there are others. And this just happens to be a set that I think we can look at historically and maybe take advantage of. But here are two other ideas. We have search engines. Search engines give us answers. The trouble with answers, especially when they're based on my history, is they're about the past. They're not about the now. As a colleague of mine likes to say, answers are dead. Questions are about the present. So what if instead of giving me answers, you know, answer one, answer two, answer three, it gave me question one, question two, right? Aren't people that you know who are able to ask you great questions really, really good at collaborators? So I want a question engine. I don't want a search engine. Number one. This one is more my favorite one. I want a heuristic that will tell me when a conversation out there is really good. We all know the Turing test, right? The Turing test is when a human judges whether a machine is intelligent. I want to flip it. I want a machine that tells me when a conversation is intelligent. Mm-hmm. And I want to call that a Turing test. Which is a play on Turing, obviously. Proposal number four, more dance. Let's go for analog machines. Let's go for physicality.
Playing with your iPhone. It's different.
Different than playing with your iPhone is what I say there. Why can't we build from what the history tells us and become more conversational? Thank you very much.
In the spirit of conversation, we'll open the field for questions and comments and so forth.
Please.
Thanks. Well, it was really, really interesting to see it laid out in that three-point sequence. I have a question about, you said a few times that conversation, like a good conversation, involves coming to an agreement, either about the goals or the means. Do you think there's, like, what about conversations that are about almost like introducing new ideas or disrupting is a horrible word, but like there seems to be something about like intelligence can involve introducing something that changes it.
Very much so. What I would say is that although we think our goal is to go to dinner, we discover that in fact it's to have a conversation. So at some very high level, we past talked about this, a conversation is a contract to stay engaged. And as long as I think we're sufficiently on the same page, sufficiently in agreement about what we're doing and why we're doing it, then I'm going to stay in that and so are you. You can leave at any time. So
one of the so the four squares, one of those squares was conversations to create new language. That's where you introduce. And I could go deeper in that. I have other articles that I can present to you. I want to remember to remind where the URL is. This entire slide deck is online. You can pull it down and you know write to me. My email, I think, will appear in a minute. Have interactions like this. But that's where the key is. And how you design conversations for new language is a particularly hard problem. But I thought about that. I'd be happy to go on and on about that. Thank you. Other questions? I've stunned you into silence.
Nothing really structured. I was just thinking about goals and about agreements. Like, are we always need a fully agreement within the conversation, or is something can be partially down? Like, what are the levels of goals that do we need to achieve? Should be considered as that's like group conversation.
Great. So, similarly, we have to be satisfied enough that our goals are being met to stay in it. So we're not getting anywhere in this wonderful new startup we're doing, but I'm learning things. So that would be a reason for me to stay in. But also goals and means are often very vague and they're shifting all the time and they don't need to be fixed. And in any description of what conversation is, it looks antiseptic and simple, but in fact it's a very complex and difficult, messy, horrible thing. And the disagreements are very often where new ideas come, because haven't you had a conversation where you misunderstand what the other person says and you go on and on and on and on, and then they say, well, that's not what I meant, but that's great, keep going. Right? And that's part of the wonder of it, really.
You have a diagram, I think it's one of your courses from 1990 that you were presenting. Cybernetics is not AI. It has like AI, cybernetics.
Yes.
And in some of your lectures, you use that diagram.
Yep.
And you also have an example when you go to the origin, the etymology of cybernetics, when you show like the boat going and finding the goal, and you have to react, have feedback of the environment to define cybernetics. But and that diagram was very influential for me. Huh. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about that distinction, especially if you think now
AI and cybernetics.
AI and cybernetics. I'll just give an example that might trigger some questions about this distinction. If you think about one of the main branches in the current AIs, which is reinforcement learning, yeah, is doing exactly what the diagram with the boat is doing. Like, current environment, you have agents, and you're trying to learn how to behave in the environment with feedbacks. Yeah. And that's like one of the main branches of AI. So I'd like you to.
Yeah. So a couple of things in this context, and we can always talk about it more. AI makes the presumption that intelligence resides in something. Cybernetics says intelligence resides in the interaction. I have a brilliant friend, he's amazing, he knows a lot of what I've told you about today. When he walks around New York, he's gonna get killed. So in the context of the streets of New York City, he's not very intelligent, because he can't interact with them, et cetera. So that's one difference. Another difference is that cybernetics is not about science. Science wants to acquire knowledge, and the consequence of that in engineering and other things is those ideas from science, knowledge, are applied and you get somewhere. Cybernetics says that systems that have purpose don't care about the knowledge that they acquire except insofar as it lets them achieve their goals. So it's a performative ontology instead of a knowledge acquisition idea. So AI comes from the knowledge acquisition idea. The knowledge in the world comes into the machine and the machine knows and then the machine can behave. It's, again, it places the importance in the wrong place, to say it that way. And as a consequence, the kinds of things you look for in an AI system are different than the kinds of things you need in cybernetics. Joey Ito is the head of the MIT Media Lab. You know his name. He's succeeded Negroponte, more or less. And he is writing now a lot about cybernetics, and wanting to put forth the idea that this science enlightenment thing hasn't gotten us very far, and can design and second order cybernetics, which is something in particular, help science, unquote. So he's onto something there that we're not getting better with just science, and maybe not even with just design. The question is, can a multidisciplinary, or as another word is, anti-disciplinary viewpoint like cybernetics, which is looking across what things are made of and focusing on information and purpose, can that bring something to it? And I think that's a potent set, science, design, cybernetics.
Biological evolution works through a cybernetic process.
Yeah. It's consistent in that way. We had a couple of million years to get here. That's again my complaint about, you know, chatbots are based on AI and what's been around 50, 60 years, rather than 100,000 years of us being able to do what we're doing now, quite to an amazing degree.
On the other hand, machines or AI or whatever it is are evolving faster than we are.
I'm not sure that's true.
Okay, so that colloquy, I guess the question is, would that have been AI in 1969?
No.
And is it now?
No. Because it's based on autonomous systems that have double loop structures internally, and and the behaviors that emerge are a consequence of their interactions, not a consequence of what's designed into them. And
oh, that's a long conversation.
Okay, good. I look forward to that. Yes.
It's just a follow up. I found what you said really interesting because, as he's mentioned, Gordon Pass seems almost like a designer, architect. Also, you know, he's interested in like theater. Yeah. But also, well versed in like the engineering side of things. Like,
yeah.
Know how.
Yeah. He was mean with a soldering iron. There's
right.
Some videos of that.
But as you said, like that generated as a result something quite really interesting and kind of out of the box. But how, like, I would love to ask for, because quite early, like the people working in AI are very specialized, like engineers mainly. So do you think that's part of like the issue of like where we're at right now?
Totally. Yeah, that's a very serious problem. Because it's a particular mindset. Computers are almost the worst case, right? I find that mechanical engineers, for example, have a very pragmatic way of understanding the challenge of getting things to work. And computer scientists, you can patch a patch and a patch and a patch. You know, you don't have to have much discipline to write long, complicated code. And I think that's one of the issues. And also the idea that I am in control of this machine. Mm-hmm. Joe Weizenbaum in the 70s wrote a book, Computer Power and Human Reason, and nothing has changed. And his point then was that there's a mindset that attracts software programming, which of course is much more crude in those days than it is now. And as a consequence, the things we get computers to do are from that mindset. And I think AI and machine learning is a classic case of that now. So the enrichment of ideas from a variety of points of view, I think is essential. Otherwise, we're going to have more machine learning and less humanism. And the combination of it all is good. And it's more than just human and AI, the way Stanford's talking about.
But I think my follow-up question is it about bringing people together from different disciplines, or is it you becoming, in essence, a hybrid of these disciplines?
I think certainly the former. Certainly mixing people together is important, and you need a depth of expertise. If you're capable of having all of those different insights internally to oneself, that's better, because one could argue that, you know, you don't get Picasso or Einstein or Pasque from a team, right? There are certain moments in time when the creativity requires it all going on in one head. That's another conversation we can have. So I think both would be the better answer. But surely you need to expose engineers and computer scientists to a range of things, because otherwise they're going to do what the computers can do instead of what the people need them to do. That's the bottom-up problem, right? Mm-hmm. It's not an area I've worked in, but I'm curious about it, and if you are interested, I'd love to have a conversation about it. The principles, I think, are much the same. What are the things that you can talk about that have a shared understanding, more or less, and despite impairments in perception, can we have things that we can point to that are the base agreements and build up ideas from there? It's just what language is. So how do you overcome what may be modal limitations and get to the idea space and then have interactions there?
having physical capabilities there is very often helpful. Even cross-disciplinary, to the prior question, there's this idea of boundary objects, where people across disciplines are trying to work on the same problem. You have to have something to focus on, otherwise I say X and you say X, but we don't mean the same thing.
It's like, think about Alexa or Cortana or whichever. It's always going to forget what you talked about before.
I couldn't agree more.
So it's...
And this is one of the fundamental limitations. I've had discussions with people that hear it, and I said, are you working on that? Oh, yeah, we're working on that. That's in the advanced group. Well, you know, call me when you're done. Seriously.
Yeah, but we're only 60 years in.
Touché. But, see, I would push back on that, and I would say... They don't have the theory or the formalism to draw from in order to know how critical that is. And they, you can recognize the speech and you can speak back, solved. Let's stop worrying about that and letting me turn on lights or know what the weather is, and let's work on this problem. I think it's one of the great unsolved problems of the year for chaplains.
What would a conversation with Alexa look like if this construct was embedded in the technology? How would it change? What would a conversation be?
Well, at the moment I get up in the morning and I say, play NPR. And it knows which NPR station I want. So it's helping me a little bit there. But what if I woke up in the morning and I said, what should I be listening to? And it questioned me and my interests and wondered what I might want to focus on. What mood was I in? What was I curious about? Did I know that something happened the other day which was related to something? What would a friend help you with? And I don't want to anthropomorphize the machine, but it is based on what you know of the other person as a foundation. But you don't have to know things. You just have to be willing to ask questions and respond to those questions. That's why my question engine is, I think, more interesting than a search engine giving you results. So it would be of the form of a negotiation to see what I might want. Because there are things I know that I want, and there are things I don't know that I could want. Mm-hmm. And that allows me to become something I'm not now. And so for me,
isn't that how something like Pandora works? You tell it you want to hear a piece of music and it kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beginning to get in that direction.
Yeah.
But I can't say to Pandora, I'm too agitated for that. Or can you soften that a little bit? Or less. It's like when you go to a yoga studio and they're playing guitar music. It doesn't make any sense.
Just add to that. I've been telling my advisor and all my cohorts, I was like, I had this background in architecture, but when I come to CMU, so much focus is on computation. And the biggest difference I found between the two disciplines, engineering and computation, you're given really well-packaged problems, and then you solve them.
Right.
In architecture and design, it's about
defining
the
problem.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So.
Totally. And that emerges through conversation, whether it's with yourself, or with your client, or with the team. One could talk about social issues, too, and wicked problems, and how that's all a matter of framing and how you look at it. That's the second order move, by the way, is instead of saying, I'm going to describe the system and I'm going to get it the way it really is, versus I'm going to describe the system based on my values, which I am responsible for, and those values determine what I see, and therefore what I might do. That's second order design or second order segment. That's another whole.
Do you
want to
miss the question or comment?
So this gentleman's question over here started to get at, I guess, what I was curious about. But so you pointed to a lot of examples of what you feel is wrong or misguided with current attitudes and practices in technology. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on how our world, our daily lives would look different on sort of an alternate timeline. If the paradigms that you push for in this presentation were implemented or taken more seriously, 40, 50 years ago?
I don't know. I was asked to do some future casting for Samsung. I was one of 10 designers who was asked to project in 10 years. And everyone else wrote in 10 years, such and such will be happening and so on. And they were very smart and interesting. I couldn't do that. The only thing I could do was to start from today and say, I'm a human being, I sense and I act based on my purpose. My phone is an extension of me. It's an extension of the nervous system. I can see afar and I can act afar. Therefore, what would I want my technology to help me with? And I developed an architecture based on that. I seem to be unable or unwilling to project in that way, so I apologize that I can't answer it. But I would start from this, and I would say, what is the humane way forward? It's a bit of what's behind my idea of an ethical interface. You know, let's not have as many different nonprofit organizations saying, we will be ethical with AI. Let's define what we mean by having an interface that is ethical and build the damn thing. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you everyone for coming.